Welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How do we fix our country's failing schools? Some of the loudest voices in the national debate call for school closures, teacher layoffs, vouchers, and more charter schools. But today's guest, David Kerp, has an entirely different idea about how to do better with what we already have. It involves listening to and supporting teachers, administrators, students, parents, and whole communities. David spent a year in one school district, Union City, New Jersey, where kids had been failing. According to Kerp, Union City is a place with an unemployment rate of 60% higher than the national average. Three quarters of the students live in homes where only Spanish is spoken, and a quarter are thought to be undocumented, living in fear of deportation. So how did this community become a model for school success? David says the schools in this area used to be factories for failure, but now, he says, Union City offers a nationwide strategy for fixing low-performing schools. And he lays it all out in his new book, Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. Thanks for joining us, David.
Holly, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. David Kerp is a nationally known education expert. He is a professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. And after the 2000 election, David served on President Obama's transition team. And we'll talk about that because there's something in the budget that you worked on that Obama is proposing now. So I want to get to your book. I want you to tell us about spending this year in Union City. But first, I was wondering if you would tell us what you think of the way that we talk about education and education reform. No Child Left Behind, teaching to the test, charter schools, even the language I used, failing schools, mm-hmm. market-driven reforms. How do you think that the framing, the language that we use, affects the way we think about this?
Well, I think it's a great way to start because what we have is a narrative of failure. The schools aren't. The kids aren't. What can we do to reinvent what it is that we have?
Or even the term dropout, right?
Right.
It's like it's the kids'
fault. Right, exactly. And the language, you know, at risk, child at risk, which basically means, you know, you think at some point down the road she's likely to drop out or flunk out of school. And we're so used to hearing this, right, that what we've got isn't working, it's broken. I think people are dispirited by this mm-hmm. because if you look at the data on charter schools, it's not particularly impressive. There are great charter schools, but overall they do no better than public schools. And they're more segregated than public schools. They're less likely to admit kids with special needs. They're less likely to admit kids who don't speak English. And that's a huge chunk of the population in California. So we have people calling for the market as if what you were doing was selling, you know, a computer or bottle of soda, and not trying to educate kids. A lot more complicated tale than that. And that, I think, is why I wrote a piece for the New York Times a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And it became the second most widely emailed piece in that time.
Congratulations. I have a bunch of questions, actually, from some people who left comments that I wanted to bring
that's
up.
That's great. I got a note from somebody which says you beat the Pope, because that was the day the Pope decided he was going to resign. And I thought,
wow, big story.
I fell out of that note.
All right, so let's get to this book, Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. I love this title. So you spent a year in Union City, New Jersey. What led you to that place in the first place?
Well, I'd been to Union City earlier because I was writing about early education, and it is a great preschool system. And while I was there,
Do they have universal preschool?
They have universal preschool for 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds, full-day preschool, and for the poorest of kids, they have services before and after school so parents can drop their kids off and come back whenever they come back, which is crucial for a community where everybody is working, doing mm-hmm. something. It works well for those there. You have almost 100% of the 4-year-olds and most of the 3-year-olds who are in preschool, which is, for Latino families who are used to having the kids close, it's a recognition that they're going to learn a whole lot in that wonderfully warm and welcoming environment. So there I was in Union City, and I thought, this is a school district whose test scores all the way through 8th grade are really good. I want to see what's going on here. Is it a test factory? Is it skill and drill? And so I was in a school that was a K to eight school, and I wandered in the classrooms, just randomly picking a classroom, opening the door and sitting in for a while. And I saw some okay teaching. I saw some very good teaching. I saw a surprising amount of inspiring teaching. What I didn't see was either the loafing, lazy teachers or the teachers who basically were just treating kids as parrots who were going to memorize stuff. And I thought, this is fascinating. What's going on here? How did this place manage to be as how did this place pull it off? And, you know, I knew that 25 years earlier, it was the worst, the second worst school district in the state of New Jersey.
Hmm.
So how did this place go from worst to first?
And did it take 25 years?
It's been a gradual process, a process of continuous improvement. Things got better in the early 90s and continue to get better. They had to, because if they hadn't, the state was going to take over the system.
So they were under this threat of a federal takeover, which has actually happened here in a few local
right, a state
school
takeover,
districts.
Actually.
State takeover. So what did they do, and what's the formula here that you think is this model?
Well, what they did was to realize that they needed to focus on two things. They had a lot of kids, as you mentioned, who are Latino kids who come to school not speaking English. So they needed a really good bilingual system. And they realized what the linguists have been saying for a while, that you need a grounding in your home language.
So literacy in your native language.
Literacy in your native language, which means reading, writing, and speaking before you transition gradually to English. And they developed that program. Over the years, they developed programs for kids who've come in a lot later, and we can talk about that down the road. And the other thing they understood was that these kids weren't in an environment where there were lots of books around. Parents were busy. Parents were tired, didn't have the time to read to their kids, didn't have a lot of education, because it is a poor community. Basically a community of farmers from all over Latin America who've come for the standard American dream reasons. They want to give their kids a good education. And so the schools became this word-drenched, language-drenched, writing-drenched environment. So that was the start. Find a curriculum that is really good to help kids learn their native language and move into English, and then offer them a rich array of reading and writing and see what happens, and then build out of that a curriculum that you develop that works from grade to grade to grade and across schools, so that families that move are going to be in a consistent environment.
And you said that the educators actually developed the curriculum, and that shouldn't sound radical, but it kind of is.
Union City has been a homegrown place in every way, shape, and form. The guy who led this effort, a fellow named Fred Carrig, was a local. You have a lot of people who I think of as lifers. That is, people spent their entire careers in Union City. Most of the teachers fit that description. Most of them are homebodies. Most of them haven't moved more than 100 miles from where it is that they were growing up and they're teaching in those schools. And today, when the curriculum keeps evolving, keeps improving, it's teachers in the system who are picked to spend a chunk of the summer developing new curriculum models. So it is very much community-based, teacher-based, parent-engaged kind of a place.
So how did they get the buy-in, the community buy-in, the teacher buy-in, the parent buy-in? How did that happen?
Slowly. And I think that's really the point of this. Bit by bit by bit. The teachers, it was easier to get the teachers to buy in because it was other teachers who were saying, here's what we need to do to make things better. And it was tough because not only was the curriculum changed, the pedagogy, the way of teaching was changed too. So instead of having the kids in rows, you know, the teacher in front, a lot of direct instruction, you had the kids grouped in tables, working on a lot of hands-on project together stuff, so that somebody now would be at the computer and somebody might be at some kind of an iPad or somebody would be working in blocks. Some group of kids would be reading together. There might be some little theater going on. And so the teacher really had to learn how to teach multiple groups at the same time. Tough to do, but they began to realize over time that this was really working a whole lot better for their kids.
Well, a couple of questions about that. You mentioned this one teacher, I think, Rojas, and she said something to the effect of, my goal is to do for these kids what I do with my own children, which is hands-on teaching, using a lot of vocabulary, really kind of getting in there and learning by doing.
Susie Rojas is a fabulous teacher, and I describe in the book a lesson or making latkes, potato pancakes,
yeah.
which is a great, great story. But everything from this is a potato, how does it feel, will it feel different when you cook it, let's find out, what's going to happen when you put the potato in the food processor, let's slice up the potato, everybody's got a chance. And the moment that the pea in pepper is the same as the pea in pimiento. And the moment I loved is when the potato drops on the floor and she picks it up and says, this is what cooks do. You wipe off the potato and you keep going.
Oh, great.
So at the end of that lesson, I was roaming around the school. I came back and the kids had made latkes and they said, do you want to try one? And I said, of course. And they were great.
Did you try the one that fell on the floor?
I have no idea, right? That's the great joy of this. If it was good enough for Julia Child, it's good enough for Susie Rojas and those kids. But what was lovely is the latkes were served, the sort of traditional Hanukkah style is sour cream and apple sauce. Well, they had that, but they also, it's a Latino school, they had salsa.
That's the way I like my life.
And salsa
actually
turns out to be an improvement over this. So, you get a little cultural diversity.
But the idea there is that, A, the teacher is using her own creativity and knowledge, et cetera, and they're learning about math, right, with the measuring, learning about vocabulary, learning about culture. So it's
learning
all of this
motor
into
skills.
One.
They're motor skills. Developing motor skills as well. How do you manipulate
So I guess one of the questions that teachers might have or people like me is, how did they buck this trend of kind of needing to teach to the test, this new kind of No Child Left Behind philosophy of everybody has to be exactly on the same page. You've got to have this standardized curriculum. I don't remember what the reading, open court reading, for example, here in the Bay Area. I mean, how did they get outside of, how were they able to buck that?
Well, for starters, this is an enterprise that began and building from early education, from first grade, kindergarten, up, and when preschool arrived, was added to the mix in the late 90s, they do preschool. So they've really built a system before No Child Left Behind takes effect in 2000,
okay.
in 2002.
Uh-huh.
But it's a really good question because, like everybody else, Union City's claim to fame is how well it does on those tests. So the fact that those kids are performing at statewide average all the way through from third grade through eighth grade is amazing. I mean, it gives them street cred. And to me, more important, the fact that 90% of those kids are graduating. It's a fabulous accomplishment.
And I forget what percentage you said were going on to college. It was
75%,
really high.
75% are starting college. Those are remarkable figures. But what Union City, like every district and every good teacher has to do is this creative dance. So the core of the enterprise is a good teacher, a challenging curriculum, and an engaged student. That's where everything starts. That's what you've got to build out from. So that's where the projects and a curriculum that cuts across art and science and literature and math. That's
where
that
works. Mentioned
fun,
engaging students,
yes.
and having learning be fun as opposed to this horrible thing that you have to do and memorize.
Exactly.
And
but there's a chapter, when I come back to this, I spent a lot of time in one elementary school in this fabulous classroom of immigrant third graders who are learning English while they're prepping for the first big test. And when I come back to that school in the winter, the chapter is called Where Fun Comes to Die, parentheses, and be reborn after the test. Because what winds up happening is that the teachers have to figure out a way to get those kids test ready, mm-hmm. even as they're trying to keep education live and engaging. And it's a very, very fine dance that they wind up doing. What that mixes is something that any teacher is listening to the show, any administrator is going to understand the difficulties, the challenges of doing it and getting it right.
Well, and that's a really good entree to invite our listeners to join this conversation with David Kirp, who is a professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, and he is the author of this new book, Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and you can join David Kirk at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. What do you think it would take to give students a first-rate education, and how involved in your public schools are you? If you're a parent or a teacher, administrator, or student, what improvements do you think could be made in your school? And if you're a teacher especially, how do you deal with this creative dance between the test and and engaging your students and trying to be a creative teacher? 866-798-8255. 1-800-273-8255. If you know of great examples here in Northern California in your own school of school success, let us know about them. Give a shout out, 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, David, what about this idea? You talk about community schools and engaging parents in this process, and there's a couple of things that I think are interesting about that. Obviously, one of the things that they found for student achievement and success is parental involvement. But there's a lot of schools, teachers, and administrators that really don't want to necessarily invite the parents in. How did they do it in Union City, New Jersey?
Well, again, I think it's a close community. And while, as we're talking about Union City because I spent a year there and because it's a very dramatic tale. It's not as though this is a one-shot school. I looked across the country at other places that have also improved achievement, that have closed the achievement gap. And what they're doing is stuff that any educator knows. So it's really strong preschool. We've mentioned that. It's the bilingual education. It's a very word-drenched curriculum. It's figuring out ways to get teachers to collaborate with each other, to work with each other, because as anybody who's been in a classroom knows, that's how you learn to teach. You mm-hmm. learn to teach by teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Being
mentored, which is
something
we're
mentored.
Losing.
So you have the experienced teachers working with the less experienced teachers. You have coaches coming in classrooms. It's the medical model, in effect. It's watch one, do one. Teach one.
Say it again. Watch one, do one, teach one.
Because the teachers who have learned from their, you know, from folks, from the veterans, at some point themselves become veterans and wind up teaching. It's collaborative, not competitive, so that Latka's lesson isn't just Susie Rojas's lesson.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lesson for all the pre-K teachers to use. And she'll bring in the equipment and leave the equipment, you know, for
but
others to use.
But then you're talking about establishing a culture here.
Yes,
That is frequently different than the kind of competitive, zero-sum culture that I think a lot of people feel like they're operating under, and a budget acts constantly.
No, I think it's essential. And this is something that the way in which a school superintendent, you know, treats the system, builds a system, builds a culture, supports folks, is crucial. And I talk a bit in the book about Sanger, California, which is a dirt poor farming town near Fresno, you know, where 15 years ago, the hostile relations between teachers and administrators was so great that there was a sign entering town, new teachers, beware, don't come here, the school system hates you. I mean, that's amazing, right?
No.
And now you have a much more connectedness. And what's happened is that the superintendent and the administrators have invited teachers and the teachers union into the conversations about education, not just about salaries. So Long Beach.
So they got rid of that really adversarial culture that I think exists in a lot of places. Right now.
Absolutely.
And teachers feel like they're under the gun, that they're to blame for everything that's wrong with the school.
Absolutely. And one of the great things about San Francisco, and one of the essentials to making this work, is stability. You know, we can talk about all those elements, the assessment, you know, the support of teachers, you know, the building of a curriculum that's coherent from grade to grade, that's consistent from school to school, so that poor kids who move a lot aren't going to get lost. But if you don't have consistent leadership, if you have a revolving door superintendent, then you're in trouble. And so the fact that San Francisco had a superintendent who was here for 6 or 7 years, mm-hmm. then retires, and Richard Carranza comes in, tutored, mentored.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of is right there to take over the job and carry on. That is the prescription for success. Without that, you can't do anything.
And yet instability is in so many ways built into the way that we fund our schools, so that you don't know whether or not your teachers are coming back, that they're getting these pink slips every year, that in the most low-income schools, frequently that's where you have the least experienced teachers and much more teacher turnaround. I mean, it's built into the way that we do schools right now.
No, and the testing only adds to this because, you know, why is there turnover at the top? Well, the classic story is the new superintendent comes in, and the first year she looks around and finds that where the bodies are buried and what's going on. And the second year she gets worried about test scores because that's going to be the metric by which she's judged. And the third year, either somebody is running for the school board to defeat this newcomer, or she's looking for a job elsewhere. And you get this kind of turnover. And for teachers, as you say, the fact that the budgets have been trimmed consistently.
Up until this year. Thank you, California voters.
You know, exactly. So we've been, you know, this is a moment to celebrate in California. To get Californians to be willing to increase taxes to support education is really a milestone moment for us.
I wonder what you think of this emphasis that we've had for probably the last 10 years or so of on choice, which on one hand is a good thing, but does that increase instability in terms of if you're trying to run a school system and you don't know where your students are going to come from or how many or what your budget is going to be, how is that, how do you balance that whole idea of choice and empowering parents and students to find good schools and yet to still manage a school system, that, a functioning school system?
Well, people talk about having a portfolio of schools in a school system. The places that I know that have worked best are places where there are charter schools. There aren't any charter schools in Union City, by the way, but there are charter schools at the margin. There are charter schools. They really have built a strong, solid system.
So that people want to be in it.
So that people want to be in it. And there are going to be gradations and variations within those schools. But again, the fact that you are building out of this sort of loose confederacy of schools, each one going its own way, some good, some bad, some whatever, into a solid school system in which you do build a culture, that seems critically important.
Okay, so we have a ton of callers that I want to get to. We're about to go to a break, though. Let me just ask you, before we go to this break, we've got a couple of minutes, how did they pay for it? Is New Jersey funding their schools in a different way, at a higher level than we are? What's that secret sauce?
So New Jersey and some of the other successful places fund their school systems hugely generously. You know, I walk around this school where we're sitting right now.
We're in Burton High School, Philip and Sally Burton High School, which is featured today in the Chronicle for getting its testing up, its graduation up, et cetera.
And overcoming, right? Overcoming the odds of being in a school that, you know, if the teachers here and the administrators here went to Union City and saw the high school, they would think they were third world folks who'd come to the first world and seen what was going on. It is spectacular. And it would be wonderful to have those kinds of resources. But we know two things. Lots of money doesn't guarantee success. There are lots of school districts in which money was poured in and nothing good has happened. The other thing that I'd say is when I went looking nationwide, I wanted to know whether Union City is so special that it really isn't something that you can learn from elsewhere. So I looked at one of the things I looked at was bigger school districts and as well as smaller ones and those that are well funded and those that are badly funded. So just a second. Let me just take Aldean, Texas, which nobody who's listening to this has probably heard of. It's Houston.
I hadn't.
It's Houston's poor. It's Houston's poor cousin. They spend $8,000 a year on kids, which is a bit less actually than we do. And those kids are doing amazingly, and they're doing amazingly well. They're graduating at high rates. It's a Latino African American school district, bigger than Washington D.C., bigger than Boston, and they're doing it by sticking to those tried and true practices, from early education to the teacher support to the language-rich curriculum to the bilingual, all that stuff, assessment and supporting kids and supporting teachers that we know works. The trick is to do it, to get it right. It's a tortoise versus hare story.
So, and you advocate for the tortoise approach.
Slow and steady wins the race. And we don't have those folks who promise you overnight miracles. Well, you know, there's no evidence. Let's put it politely. There's no evidence that they've got the answers.
And that's generally, though, as somebody who's been watching school reform here locally, what I see is this kind of pendulum of reform. So you've got the small schools, and you get this money from outside, the Broad Foundation, the Gates Foundation, transformed Oakland schools into small schools, and then poof, the money disappears, and we put Humpty Dumpty back together again. How do we get out of that cycle?
Well, we try to educate the big foundations that at the margin, you know, gimmicks don't work. And the very good news on that front is that Bill Gates wrote an op-ed piece for the Washington Post saying all this sort of test-based teacher evaluation, not so good.
All right, and we will pick up there in just a minute. David Kirp is professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, author of Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
This is Your Call on KALW. To join in today's conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you prefer to write rather than call, please feel free to send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. We are supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. In celebration of his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, Sedaris will be visiting San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House Sunday, May the 5th, for an evening of all new readings and recollections. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, what is the power of a poem? April is National Poetry Month, so we're going to speak with poets and you about your favorite poems. Friday, of course, is our weekly media roundtable. We'll be speaking with journalists about the coverage of this week's news. Monday, how will the Monsanto Protection Act affect the food supply, and what do we need to know about GMOs? And today we are talking about what will it take to improve our public school system. We're speaking with David Kerp, who's professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, and he's the author of the new book, Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. He believes that students must become thinkers, not just test takers. And with so much focus on testing, how do we get there? You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And you can leave comments and continue this conversation at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. And let's go to our callers. Let's go to Sharon in Redwood City. Hi, Sharon. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi, Holly. Thank you. I was calling because you're talking about having a different culture, and I completely, completely agree with you. But what I've seen, there goes the dog, what I've seen is in schools that are No Child Left Behind, and my girls went to a program improvement junior high and a program improvement high school, is that everything is completely prescripted. I mean, prescripted to the point where you have monitors who will come in, and you are all on page 20 on paragraph 2. And the kids who are in either AP or IB, which is International Baccalaureate, in the high schools, they get to do the fun stuff. They get to do the hands-on stuff. But I volunteer with the kids that are in support, and everything is dry and rote and boring and drilled, and I don't know why they stick with it, the kids. I mean, I really give them credit for sticking with it because it is deadly.
Yeah. All right. So stick with us, Sharon, and let's hear from David about this, whole prescriptive learning.
These are depressing stories. I don't know why people think that the way in which, you know, kids learn by hands-on doing, and that's what we do in AP classes, why it isn't that, why other folks, other kids aren't going to learn this way, or differently put, if you drain the joy out of learning, and I'm with you. I mean, the notion that these kids actually stick to it is amazing. And the farther the kids in poor schools are the ones who are most likely to get skill and drill math and reading all the time. And that does drain the joy out of learning. It also means they never get to be thinkers. So they'll do fine in the third, fourth, fifth grade tests.
Right.
But when they get to high school and middle school, when you actually, you know, are in the problem, have to be in the problem solving mode, they're going to be lost. And, you know, you wind up training a generation of folks who aren't going to be able to make it in college.
And that's why ninth grade is the year that you've got that big bubble where the students just leave the school system.
Exactly. Yeah. Ninth grade is that critical tipping point year.
That tipping point year. So conspiracy theorists sort of say that this is a way to kind of delegitimize the public school system and shut it down.
Well, I think we've got to remember that No Child Left Behind's biggest backer was a retrograde Republican named Ted Kennedy. This was a serious, good faith, bipartisan effort, and it was. It was the major bipartisan piece of legislation passed during George Bush's administration. And you know, the theory
was the bigotry of low expectations.
Soft bigotry of low expectations. And I just came back from the Education Department talking to some of the senior officials there. And I said to them, you know, incentives matter a lot. And so it's really important to get them right. And one of the senior folks said to me, you know, we're just realizing what a powerful hammer we have. And I thought, oh, my goodness, they've been around for 4+ years and they're just coming to realize this. I think that we're we're going to move away from that hyper-emphasis on this couple of tests. You know, where we go, where the Common Core curriculum takes us and the tests take us, not so clear. But my hope is, you know, that what a number of California districts are trying to do, which is to develop, for example, a teacher evaluation system, which is much more modulated, takes into account a great many things, not just how well are kids doing on these tests, suggests that we're pushing back.
And how do we change this dynamic of the program improvement and putting kids into these programs that are very rote?
Well, by looking at the counterexamples that are out there. By hiring school administrators who get that, remember that magic triangle, the engaged student, the challenging curriculum, and the comp and the able teacher. Well, you disable the teacher, the kid is going to be bored to tears, and the curriculum is anything but challenging. So if a superintendent comes in and says, I'm going to get test scores up no matter what, that's not somebody that a school district wants to recruit. The places that do well, that do really well, a place like Union City, a place like Montgomery County, Maryland, aren't places that treat students as if they were parents.
And Sharon, are you still there?
I'm still here.
What do you think schools should be doing differently? What worked for your own kids?
Well, you know, I would love to see testing go away. We spend so much time on test prep, and the teachers are so exhausted that the time after tests are over is almost lost time. The teachers are done. And the problem is the good teachers, the teachers who know how to teach creatively, are leaving the program improvement schools where we need them most because they cannot teach the way they know they need to teach. So I don't know.
Of testing altogether.
I would get rid of testing. And the other thing we need, and Denise Pope has said this, colleges need to change what they're looking at.
Hmm. That's really interesting. I'd like to get David's take. Thank you so much for joining us, Sharon. And let me hear from other listeners about solutions. What do you think we can do? And how do we as a community come together, get more involved in our schools, and change this dynamic? 866-798-TALK is the toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And if you have an example of a good school or program in your neighborhood, let us know about it, 866-798-8255. Go ahead and respond to this idea of getting rid of tests.
Now, I understand the impulse because we spend much, much too much time in classes prepping for those high-stakes tests. Again, it's the time when fun comes to die. And what was amazing in Union City was to be there after tests and see the kids come to life and see the teachers come to life and be able to do what they wanted to do. But there's a reason for tests. I mean, tests assess how much kids know, and they become the basis for targeting help to those kids. They also assess.
Well, that's the idea.
That's the idea. I mean, a good test will do that, and a good test will also pinpoint where teachers need help. The trick is not to make the test so, so important that they drive out everything else.
Or that you have, I think it was El Paso, this example of them conspiring to cheat on the test because it was so important.
I think you're thinking about Atlanta, where the superintendent was just indicted for a conspiracy, if that's the right word, of teachers and administrators. The problem, and this, by the way, is not an Atlanta story. This is a national story. We've had examples in New York and Philadelphia and Washington and all over the place. If you're under unrealistic pressure, you a teacher, you an administrator, to get students to perform at a crazy level, to spend all your time doing that, and the students don't get there, and your job is on the line, you can predict that cheating is going to go on, that they're going to do what it is that they need to do in order to survive on the job. So it's a really depressing story. But what's depressing about it is, as the caller was suggesting, the hyperemphasis on testing, which is what leads to this in the first place.
As opposed to using testing as a way to measure what needs to be done to reach the students who maybe are not catching on. We have a lot of callers, and I want to get to as many as possible so that they can talk with you, David. Jason in Salinas, welcome to your call. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So I'm actually a full-time tenured faculty member at a community college.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Or tenure track. Almost there. And the last caller actually ended her phone call with a great segue for me. She said colleges need to change what they're looking for or looking at. And I actually disagree. In the community college system in California, every year we are having to put additional resources into basic skills classes, just getting students to the ability of even writing a basic paragraph or doing basic math. And what I wanted to ask the panelist about is, are there any efforts to have higher ed also communicate better with public schools? Because what we are seeing, I serve on the Basic Skills Committee on my campus. Increasingly, every year we have students coming in that have been given a high school diploma or GED equivalent, and they are not prepared for college coursework.
So let's stay on the line with us, Jason, and let's hear what David has to say.
So you point out that one of the little secrets of the high school graduation exam is that if you squeak by, you have about the equivalent of a ninth grade education. So you're going to come to community college or Cal State, and you're going to be taking remedial classes, and you're at substantial risk of dropping out because those classes aren't any fun, and you really haven't begun your college career. I don't know. Community colleges, school by school, and the Cal State system has reached into the high schools, has worked with high school teachers and high school kids, has talked about what the expectations were for college, has gotten the teachers and students to modify what their programs look like in junior and senior years so that they really have a sense of what the demands are going to be. That's reduced somewhat at the Cal State system, the number of students who come in underprepared, but you're right.
But the community
college
system is the point of entry for many low-income students. And
well, as I say, school by school, you're going to get initiatives that exist. And we don't have a community college system. We have a bunch of community colleges. And so what they do, each one of them is basically on its own. With no significant central authority. So you'd find a great example in one school and nothing going on in another school. And that's a whole other story.
And do you have a prescription, Jason?
I really think that there has to be more of a systemic approach. Everything from relooking at how new teachers are even being trained currently, because if old standards are being taught the same to the teachers that are going to be replacing current teachers, then you're not going to see very much change. And so I think that I like the tortoise approach, but I think as part of that tortoise approach, there have to be a lot of different turtles that are looked at, if you will, and that it can't just be the public school.
Block that metaphor.
Yeah. and I think that one of the hopes with David's book, Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools, is to spark this kind of a conversation and to get people talking to each other and figuring this out. So thanks for calling, Jason.
Great. I look forward to reading the book.
And
thanks, Jason.
Let's go to Allison in Santa Cruz. Hi, Allison. Welcome to your call.
Hi. So I was a middle school classroom teacher. I was a teacher in the 1990s, loved teaching, never thought I would leave. And then by 2003, I just really felt squeezed out of a profession that I thought I would be in for my life. I couldn't do the types of teaching I was prepared to do. I was frustrated by pacing guides and exams. I worked in a high-need district in Salinas, California. I ended up leaving the classroom and actually going back to school, and I'm finishing up a PhD in education. So when it was time for my kids to go to school, I was very surprised, but what I chose to do was send them to a local non-charter alternative school in Santa Cruz, Monarch Community School, where they received an amazing K-6 education with teachers that taught a lot like I taught when I was in the classroom in the 90s, but it was called alternative in 2000. Hands-on, project-based, lots of formative assessments. Kids were in multi-age groupings. They weren't grouped by grade level. With thematic instruction, so social studies and language arts was integrated with science and math. And what I wanted to comment on was a troubling trend I saw at among the parents, actually, at the school. When I first started, when my kids first started there, I gleefully signed waivers to have them not take the standardized test every year. And most of the parents in the school did the same thing. It was a small school, 100 kids. None of the targeted, there wasn't a problem because they weren't receiving Title I funding. But what I did notice is over the course of the years, they're in middle school and high school now, more and more parents began opting to take the test. They weren't pressured by the school, but what I what I think is that they began to feel the pressure, the accountability pressure, the accountability press of the rhetoric of standardized testing.
Let's get David to respond to that, Allison.
Okay. You know, when I hear this, Allison, I think about a moment in the classroom I was sitting in where a young girl, Roisa, it was November, and she asks the question when the teacher is discussing something, will this be on the New Jersey ASK, which is their standard test? And so that family had come to the U.S. less than 2 years earlier.
And still got it.
So that culture really is pervasive. And that set of attitudes is pervasive. On the one hand, the good news in that is that the parents are interested. The bad news is that they don't get, that because of the culture in which they live, they don't understand what it is that they really want for their daughter, what they would love to see their daughter emerge from school knowing and being able to understand.
And let's go quickly to Wes in Watsonville because he needs to go teach. Hi, Wes. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My class is about to, I'm a current high school teacher. They're about to walk in right now. But I just want to ask very quickly, what do you think the impact of charter schools is on regular high schools? I almost see it as a bit of a brain drain. I'm wondering what that impact is in regards to whether we have testing or not. When you're taking the, best and the brightest out of the regular public schools, what's that overall impact, and whether No Child Left Behind and other policies led to that brain drain?
Now, I think there are great charter schools, there are terrible charter schools. Some of the high school charter schools are really superb, some not. I think it's important for the high school to make its case. And that means getting out of the skill and drill business and offering things like the International Baccalaureate Program and advanced placement classes, not just for the kids who are doing straight A's, but for the kids who are trying hard. What I loved about Union City was that they didn't have charter schools, but they had a lot of parochial schools, and the same kind of brain drain was going on. When they saw what was happening in the public schools, they left the parochial schools and returned to the public schools. It can happen. It's tough to make it happen.
Well, thank you, Wes. Let's go to Leah in Berkeley. Hi, Leah.
Hi there. I mean, there's just so much to say. I mean, one thing I have to say, like having been involved very much with my kids' education, I think testing per se is maybe not such a bad idea because it does kind of show them, where the kids are. I mean, I look at the questions they ask. I mean, it is kind of stuff that you want them to know, like basic math, English, reading, understanding. But I think it's just way too many hours. I think they can achieve what they want to know within an hour for English and an hour for science and an hour for math. I think within an hour you should be able to get pretty close to, what the kids need to know. But they test for 6-8 hours. And I agree, once testing is over, the teachers are like, the year is done. And then the other point I wanted to make, having one gate student and one child who is very dyslexic, the schools, statistically 20% of the children in an English-speaking language are dyslexic. Hmm. And in my experience and that of other parents I know, the school does not want to deal with dyslexic students, and the special ed people are absolutely not trained to help with that. So I think those kids really end up scoring super, super low because they cannot read the questions. They cannot read the math questions. They cannot read the science questions. And I think that the special ed teachers really need to use evidence-based approaches that work, which they're out there. I received private tutoring for my son, and it helps. But the school has never really done anything that has been helpful. In fact, their pull-out services actually has been less than a benefit for my son.
Well, thank you, Leah. And it sounds like what she's saying is, let's not pull the pendulum all the way to, getting rid of testing. There is a place for it, right?
Indeed. And I think, I don't know what the situation is that Leah's kids encountered, but one of the things that parents with profound special needs discover is how grateful they are for the public school system, because that is one thing that public schools do and underwrite that charter schools and vouchers don't. Those are the places that say, goodbye, we don't want to deal with you. And so, it's the public schools that really provide that service. They could certainly do a better job, But they're the place to for those parents to be going, sending their kids.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're speaking with David Kerp. He's a professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, and his new book is Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. And he will be speaking at Books, Inc. In San Francisco on Chestnut Street on April 22nd. Is that next Monday?
It's a week from Monday.
A week from Monday at 7 p.m. We'll put that information at yourcallradio.org. And let's take another caller, Joe in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Call.
Thank you. Yeah, so I kind of agree with your author. My children had the opportunity to go to Alice Fong U in San Francisco, and they just won the Blue Ribbon National Award, and the teacher won the Terrence Bell Award.
And that's a bilingual Chinese immersion program, right?
Yes, it's a Cantonese Chinese immersion program, and they also teach the kids Mandarin in sixth grade. And they start out in kindergarten doing their stuff in Chinese for 80% of the day on the first day of kindergarten. And one of the reason why I think it works is the same reason your author is talking about, is the fact that it's a very clear program that the principal founded, and all the professionals who work there believe in the program. And so the teachers and the principal are working together to build this really amazing language immersion program where they graduate 60 kids a year, bilingual in Chinese and English.
And, well, thank you, Joe.
And they get top, they have the highest test scores in the city now for the last 5 years.
That's great. Let me get David to respond, because I believe that David has noticed a lot of other things happening in San Francisco that are really great models. You talked about parent involvement as well.
I think this is a system that's building out on a bunch of ways. That's a wonderful program, and as you say, what makes it and other special programs really interesting is it attracts a group of dedicated parents. Those kids are going to stay in that program. The teachers are going to stay in that program. There is a culture there. And a stability there. But it's 60 kids. And the question is, how do you build a system that provides this kind of richness and culture? And some of it involves special schools like this one. But a lot of it involves the kind of schools that the previous caller was talking about, the ordinary schools. How do you build a strong culture in those schools that is not totally test-driven?
And you said that San Francisco Unified is a model for involving parents and creating a parenting system. What's happening here that we should know about?
Well, there's more and more effort, emphasis on community schools, which means engaging parents and other partners in kids' education so that the school day isn't just the 8-to-3 day, but it reaches before and afterwards. And more generally, there is an effort to reach out to families, an increasing effort to reach out to families, an increasing recognition that they're not only partners, they're the primary educators of their kids. And for starters, that means getting the material to them in their own language so they can understand what's going on. It also means making sure that teachers, to go back to an earlier call, that teachers feel comfortable talking with parents, and that parents feel comfortable talking with teachers, and that's something that the district is working on as well.
And I wanted to bring up one more thing. In President Obama's new budget that he's proposing this week, he put money in for early childhood education, and you consider that one of the cornerstones for a successful system. Can you talk about why you think that's so important?
Once upon a time, we thought about little kids as empty vessels that you poured whatever liquid into. But if you've ever had a little kid, you know that that's a terrible metaphor. They're little explorers. They're little Lewis's and Clark's. And the amount that they can learn, the amount that they can absorb is so remarkable. And the long-term effects so amazing. The research on this is impeccable. There are studies that date back to the 1960s showing lifelong effects of really good early education. And there's research now that's going on. In New Jersey, for example, up through fifth grade, a new study shows substantial gains for kids who've been in preschool.
Why is this such a hard sell? Is it just the money? Is it the idea that you're taking power away from kids and, I mean, from parents and putting kids into these institutions? What's the sticking point?
I think we're mostly past the we're taking power away from parents. I think, with parents working and parents getting the importance of giving their children a good experience before they get into kindergarten, they get it. It is just the money in a state where just the money is a big deal. You know, we're inching our way there with this thing called, you know, transitional kindergarten, which is really preschool by another name. My revolutionary suggestion: get rid of senior year in high school and substitute preschool. If you think about it, if you remember your senior year, if there weren't football teams, there wouldn't be a senior year in high school. You either wanted to be in college, or you wanted to be at work, but, you know, or you wanted to socialize. That was what senior year was like.
Get rid of senior year and put it into pre-K.
There you go.
There's a radical notion for you. All right, so we've got about 2 minutes left. What is one thing you want people listening to take away?
Two things. It's doable. You can build a system of strong supports. Everything that Union City and other successful districts are doing has been known to be a good thing for a long time. I mean, it just makes sense. You know, a solid bilingual program, really good early education, supporting teachers, a language-rich curriculum, mentoring, assessments that are used to help the teachers and the students, building a culture of trust, not a culture of fear. This is familiar stuff to any educator with a pulse. The trick is to stick at it. And it's hard to do that. It requires patience on the part of everybody in the system. And unfortunately, we live in a pretty impatient society. So getting away from the faddishness that we are stuck with, the brand new ideas, the small schools, the charter schools, the vouchers, the, you know, whatever the model du jour is.
Right, but there is that imperative. If it's my kid and I've only got this one shot at an education, I don't necessarily have 20 years to wait.
No, exactly. And that is indeed the tension in the system. And if you've got available to you a school like that, the Chinese immersion school, by all means, take up the option. But if you're a parent, what you really want to do is to work on what's happening with your kid in the school, with that teacher. Get engaged, get involved, participate, build a school culture. You can play a hugely important role in your child's education, and many of the parents out there will recognize that that's the lives that they've
led. And you're asking people who are parents, but their kids have gone through, maybe they're in college, maybe they're out of college, you're asking them to reengage with the public school system as well.
We need all the adult support we can get. I mean, this is what kids say over and over again. We want a caring, stable adult in our lives. So making education not just something that happens within the school, but happens in the community, with a community engaging in those kids' education in informal and formal ways, that's fabulous.
David Kirp is professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, and he is the author of the new book, Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. You can speak with him and listen to him have a talk at Books, Inc. in San Francisco on April 22nd at 7 p.m. We'll put information at yourcallradio.org. We'll put a link to his book and his work there, and you can also post comments on your ideas about what we can do to improve our public school system. And thanks to everybody who called. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What is the power of a poem? On the Next Year Call, we'll mark National Poetry Month by talking to writers and you about why poetry is important. What's your favorite poem? Do you interact with poetry in your daily life? Do you carry them in your pocket, invent limericks, compose haikus? What can poetry accomplish? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. It's Your Call with Hannah Baba and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.